AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. You're back on FYI Politics with Brett Johnson. So, with the general election less than 3 months away, hard to believe it's coming up that fast, one of the big races in Minnesota is going to determine who controls the state Senate, as Republicans currently hold a very narrow 35-32 majority, but DFLers do see some opportunities in the suburbs to pick up some seats and possibly flip control of the chamber. But one of the complicating factors in several of these state Senate races could be third parties running candidates, and specifically we're talking about the legalized cannabis parties. There's two of them that were recently granted major party status, and DFLers are concerned that some of these legalized cannabis party candidates could siphon some votes away from the DFL candidates. So joining us to talk about this and sort through it is Peter Callahan, who covers state government for MinnPost over at MinnPost.com, as he's with us now. Hey, Peter, how you doing today?
Very good. Thanks for having me.
So basically, this all stems from an issue that we had back during primary season in late February and early March, which feels like it's about a million years ago. But if we go back and look at what happened in Minnesota's presidential primary, basically all of the major parties, the DFL, the Republicans, and the two legalized cannabis parties, basically got lists of primary voters, and this is really where the controversy stems, if you can kind of take it from there, as to where things have gone to today.
Sure. Let me just go back one step previous, and that is that the two marijuana parties with two different names ran candidates statewide in 2018, and each of them got at least 5% of the vote. And that act is what made them major parties under the law. And the primary law, presidential primary law, talks about giving these lists to major parties. Well, now that means the two legalized marijuana parties got those lists. So they, if they're sophisticated enough, and I don't want to speak ill of them, that's not what I mean. I just mean, do you have enough money? Do you have enough resources? Do you have enough talent to exploit those lists? Because they can be pretty massive. But if you did, you could send to DFL candidates, or in DFL voters, because they tend to be maybe more likely to support a legalized cannabis candidate, and try to take some votes away that would otherwise go to DFL candidates, particularly in a couple of close Senate races.
And it turns out, yeah, the Republicans could be taking advantage of this list, since they get access to all the DFL lists of voters, the Republican list of voters, and the two marijuana parties, all four parties, get access to these lists. And it turns out the concern that the DFLers are expressing is not that Republicans are going to be using this list to try to convince Democrats to vote for Republicans, but they could be using it to try to convince Democrats to vote for third parties and those two marijuana major parties. That seems to be the big concern we're getting from DFL leaders, aren't we?
Yeah, you're right. And the GOP does, in fact, have the resources to take that and work those lists. And that is why there is concern that the grassroots legal cannabis candidates and the legal marijuana now candidates might have been set up by Republicans to specifically draw votes away from DFLers. They're not necessarily people who have had long experience or involvement in legalized marijuana movement. The Minnesota Reformer back in June went and found quite a few connections between some of these candidates and traditional Republican and traditional pro-Trump sentiments. So the concern is that these folks were essentially planted using the marijuana party flags to get candidates into races that are expected to be close. I mean, the ones that I'm looking at are Greater Minnesota races that aren't the number one targets for the DFL to try to win back the Senate, but are kind of in the second tier of a pretty narrow map for the DFL, meaning there just aren't that many battleground districts that might be considered up for grabs.
Yeah, and it sounds like the legalized marijuana and legalized cannabis parties at least have one candidate in every single one of these very competitive races, or thought to be competitive races. Can you talk about some of these specific seats that are up and what we know about some of these candidates that are running on behalf of both of these third parties?
Yeah, I mean, you don't know much about many of these candidates because they're all mostly, there is a congressional candidate who had run before, but they're mostly just new candidates who you really don't know much about. The complicating factor, however, is that Legal Marijuana Now has turned around and endorsed four of these candidates who have very questionable connection to the party. So any DFLer who says these people aren't really Legal Marijuana Now party candidates, all they have to do is say, gee, I've been endorsed by that party. The other party, Grassroots Legal Cannabis, has not done that with a couple of candidates who are running. And the leaders of that party are questioning why Legal Marijuana Now would want to essentially open the doors to their party and the use of their name and then endorse candidates who may be exploiting the election rules to their benefit. And you have to go back maybe one step further. It's more likely that you would get a legal cannabis vote out of a DFL Senate than you would a GOP Senate, as has been proven for the last 4 years. So it's actually working against the stated belief of these parties that they want to support candidates who will support legalization regardless of the party label they're running under. So it's working counter to their philosophy and counter to what might have been a strategy, and might speak more to sort of the disorganized nature of these new parties because they're small and they're new and they don't have a lot of people and staff or money.
Yeah, and even within both of these third parties, as you write about over at MinnPost.com, there does seem to be a divide on that aspect on, well, do we endorse some of the candidates from the two major parties if they are friendly towards legalizing cannabis? I think even going back to the 2018 election for Attorney General, if I remember right, I think one of the third party candidates ended up actually endorsing Keith Ellison. But as you've talked to some of these members of these third parties, the legalized cannabis parties, it is interesting that they do have kind of a divide on how they treat the Democrats and whether, well, should we be more pragmatic in terms of, well, hoping we get DFLers in so we can eventually legalize cannabis in the state, or do we just say, well, it is what it is and they're two major parties, we have nothing to do with them. It's been an interesting divide, as you kind of wrote about, talking to some of these people who are affiliated with both of the legalized cannabis and marijuana parties.
Yeah, right. And, you know, they were certainly third parties in 2018, but they're not third parties anymore. They're official major parties. And I don't know if you've got a minor party running now, if we have to call them fifth parties,
right.
Because there are four major parties. It was interesting. Noah Johnson in 2018 was running as an attorney general candidate. He was Grassroots Legal Cannabis name, but he'd also been endorsed by Legal Marijuana Now, and he was running in that very complex attorney general's race that had a lot of things going on that were influencing voters. That was Keith Ellison versus Doug Wardlow, and Noah thought that perhaps his presence might siphon enough votes off to give that election to Wardlow, which he did not want to have happen, so he publicly endorsed Keith Ellison. But whether that had much effect or not, it's hard to say. Over in the auditor's race, where no one really knew the two candidates, Michael Ford was running as a Legal Marijuana Now candidate, and he got almost the exact same percentage of vote as Noah Johnson did, and he didn't endorse Julie Blaha or anyone else in that race. So there could just be, if you've got a statewide race, and it's not a big race, meaning a governor's race or a U.S. Senate race, there might be just a basic 5% of the vote that is looking for, if they have the availability to vote for a Legal Marijuana Now candidate, to do so. That's what worries the DFL, that there's just a baseline voter out there who might go over and vote for those candidates. But if they're not on the ballot, they might stick with the DFL.
What's really interesting about this, too, and I had no idea that this was happening with the races this fall, is that while the state Senate, in at least most of their competitive races, appears to have one of the legalized cannabis or legalized marijuana candidates on the ballot, in the state house, we largely don't have any of those parties running candidates. What are some of the theories that you're hearing in terms of why this is happening only on the Senate side and not on the House?
Right. The only competitive race that I could find where there is a candidate who may or may not be legitimate as a marijuana legalization candidate is in 55A, and that's the rematch between Brad Tabke, the DFLer who won that race in something of an upset 2 years ago, and Eric Mortensen, the Republican, and really the more conservative of the two Republicans in that primary. That was close last time. It'll be close this time, but this time there's a Ryan Martin is running under the Legal Marijuana Now category. So there's two guesses, and I call them theories, might be giving it too much credit because I kind of made them up while I was talking to some of the party people. But one is that the DFL and the House made a concerted effort to look at legalization, to support legalization. Ryan Winkler led a group that went around the state and had town halls and had hearings and then developed legislation that's pretty acceptable to the legalized movement, meaning because it does regulate, it does tax, but it also has provision for home grow, which is a big request slash need for legal marijuana supporter to support a bill. So they kind of had more of a name that they were definitely going to be supporting this and don't mess with them. Don't challenge them. Whereas the other one is that the Senate is where the action is. So why not play in that game? That's a 35-32 GOP majority. As you said, you swing two seats and you change that majority. That's where all the money's going to be spent. That's where all the attention's going to be, is in the Senate races. So why not play there? And if in fact you have a group of Republicans, I'm not saying it's the caucus or the party per se, but let's say you have some people who kind of overthink these things and are trying to game the system, they don't want to waste their time in the House. It's very unlikely that the House is going to flip, but they definitely want to protect the Senate, especially because redistricting is coming next year. And if they lose the House, the Senate, and the governor's race, they have no veto over a partisan redistricting plan.
Right, and the House does have a much heavier DFL majority than what the Republicans have for their majority on the Senate side. But as you've had a chance to talk with some Republicans, what do they make of these accusations that they're running fake candidates on behalf of both of the legalized marijuana and legalized cannabis parties? What have they been making of these accusations that DFLers have been throwing at them?
Well, they deny it as a strategy, and they say, once you're a major party, you lose control over who runs under your name, and anybody can run. And it's really a free ticket to the general election. You just pay your filing fee, whereas the libertarians have been, busting a hump for the last 2 months trying to get signatures to put people on the ballot, and who knows who got Kanye West on the presidential ballot. But that required 2,000 signatures of voters. And theoretically, though, you're asserting that you did not take part in either the House or the Senate nominating process and that you support that candidate. So that's a pain. That's hard. So there is an upside for major parties that it's easier. But the big downside is you lose control of your message and you lose control of your candidates. And anyone can walk in and say they're there. And the Republicans just say, okay, careful what you wish for, but just as you can't control who files for those offices, we can't control who files for those offices. And it's possible you could just have, rogue agents, just individuals or small groups of people in a district going, hey, we could help Senator Eichhorn if one of us ran as a legalized marijuana party person. Doesn't make it less suspicious, but it can be done without a grand statewide strategy.
We're speaking with Peter Callahan, who covers state government for MinnPost over at MinnPost.com. Briefly want to touch on another piece that you recently wrote. It's from a little bit more than a week ago, but something that's an issue that's still big at the state capitol, and that has to do with the fact that Republican senators removed the commissioner of the Department of Labor and Industry, that would be Nancy LaPink, recently, and now there's concerns that Republicans could target other commissioners of the Walz administration. But what's key is that they can only vote to remove these commissioners when the state Senate is in session, which would mean Governor Tim Walz would have to call another special session for that to happen. So Governor Tim Walz does have some maneuvers that he could possibly make to try to thwart any more attempts to remove more commissioners. Peter, can you talk a little bit about what Walz has at his disposal? Because obviously the emergency with COVID is still going on, so potentially he might have to call a special session, or maybe he doesn't. Can you talk a little bit about what Walz could possibly do to prevent the removal of more commissioners?
Sure. The laws on declaring states of emergency are relatively unused in this state, meaning governors have done so for a day or two or 3 or 4 days in order to move a response to a natural disaster, for instance. There's never been anything like this or even close as far as the duration of an emergency. And the statute says that he must convene the House and Senate if they are out of session, if he wants to extend if he wants to declare a state of emergency for more than 5 days. The 5 days gets approved by the Executive Council, which is the five elected statewide elected officials. And then if he wants to go beyond that, he has to bring the session in and let them pass judgment on it. And he's been saying throughout this process, you know, I'm not sure if I actually have to call them in, but I'm erring on the side of involving them and bringing them in. So after the Nancy Lippin non-confirmation vote, I got back to the Gov's office and I said, well, what does he mean by that? Because I sure read the statute as being pretty clear. And what they might argue is that he has to do it the first time he extends the emergency for 30 days, but not each time after that. And that's the argument that they might try to make. Is it legally sound? It doesn't have to be, frankly. It just forces the Senate to sue him, sets the time clock for that action to take place, and buys time in hoping that he can flip the Senate and not have to worry about that anymore.
Oh, and that is an interesting thing.
Yeah, that's it. Well, that's, again, they've actually been thinking about that. I mean, it's kind of a scorched earth kind of a approach. But I think he feels that can you hear that?
Yep. Okay. Something that I can edit that out, yeah.
Let me make this call stop and then let's start over.
Yeah,
let's
no
start
problem.
Again. Hold on. Okay, sorry.
Yeah, no problem.
Where do you want me to start?
Oh, let's see. I'm trying to remember where I started hearing that. It actually wasn't that bad. I think what you were saying is, let's start where you're talking about what Walz might end up doing, kind of with this scorched earth approach they might be taking to this.
Okay. I mean, doing that and forcing the Republicans to sue him is something of a scorched earth policy. I mean, if he had any working relationship with the Senate GOP anymore, it would make that more difficult. But I think he might start believing soon that working relationship is spoiled anyway. And the Senate GOP has had hearings. Walker Ornstein from MinnPost has done some stories on the three hearings that were aiming primarily at environmental complaints about Walz commissioners, and that they could be coming at those commissioners. And if he feels that that's going to keep happening, he might go this route. The other thing he could probably do is let the state of emergency expire and a minute later sign a new state of emergency and sign all of the executive orders that he wants to stay in place.
Yeah, probably.
Before anyone has the opportunity to do anything. So this is a, you know, kind of Friday after six kind of a maneuver. And then it starts that clock over again as far as 5 days and 30 days and whether or not he has to, when he has to bring them back in to vote. So there's a couple of methods he could use. Whether he will really do it or not is up for debate. But the fact that he's talking about it maybe gives him the opportunity to tell the Senate Republicans, you know, if you don't stop this, I might go with this option. He may be talking about it just to give himself a bargaining position with the Senate GOP because he has none right now.
So as you're kind of hearing right now, he hasn't threatened to make any of these orders. He's just kind of floating it out there in hoping that Republicans will slow down on possibly removing any more commissioners. Is that kind of what you're gathering?
Yeah, and how actively he is doing that, I'm not certain either. Other than every single time we've asked him about the declarations, he has prefaced it by saying, I may not legally have to do it this way, but I have done so sort of out of the goodness of my heart type thing. And if he wasn't thinking about it, I'm not sure why he would keep reminding us that he had that option.
And then from the Republican perspective, has this had any impact on them, these possible threats that they're getting from the Walz administration, or are they pretty much continuing with their ideas that, well, they're going to hold more hearings on possibly removing commissioners?
Yeah, we don't have anything more scheduled beyond the ones they had for Commerce, Pollution, and one the Public Utility Commissioner. So we don't know whether they are done with that sort of public hearing. But they can't take any action, even in the committees, when they're not in session. So they would build as informational hearings. But they're saber-rattling, the governor is saber-rattling, and whether he decides to go that route, we'll see. And generally, his personality is that he doesn't like to do that. He likes to always think he can get along and talk people into stuff, and why can't we reason together? You know, unlike Governor Dayton, who sometimes seemed to relish those kinds of fights, I don't see that so much in Governor Walz. It's not his sort of governing personality, but doesn't mean that he can't be convinced to do it that way. And it's really hard to hire good people for these jobs if they know that, you know, in a month they could be removed by the Senate. It does make it difficult for him to staff his government.
Yeah, that's a great point because, yeah, who's going to want to apply for a job if they're just going to be removed in a month or so by the state Senate? So that's certainly an aspect to this as well. And, well, if he does follow through on his threat, that'll make some interesting litigation that we'll certainly be having coming up during this fall. We've been speaking with Peter Callahan, who covers state government for MinnPost over at MinnPost.com. Make sure you follow along with what he writes about the Minnesota State Legislature and Minnesota politics. Again, that's MinnPost.com. Peter, as always, appreciate the time today.
Thanks for having me, Brett. Talk to you again.